There are some example of useful commands. Instead of talking through the commands on the slides, I'm just going to bring up the GNU debugger and we can actually execute some of them and get a little bit more context. So I'm just going to go over to VMware here and going over to a virtual machine that you're going to use throughout this day. And it's a Kubuntu Precise Pangolin VM. So for the first exercise that you get to a little bit later on, that's the VM you're going to use. It's 12.04 Precise Pangolin VM. And there's a couple of these VMs on your USB in their day four book four folder. So that's where I'm at right now. And I'm just going to type in GDB for GNU debugger and then password, which is a little program that we'll mess with later on. And this is the default prompt that you get. If you want to ever clear the screen, just hit Control L to do that. And the first thing we're going to do is type info functions. And I just did tab complete. So as long as it's not colliding with another command, you can tab complete. And we hit enter. And it shows you all the defined functions. Now notice that some of them say at PLT and some of them don't. Like if we go down towards the bottom, it says check PW, granted, main. Those are all internal functions. As where these functions up top are dynamic linked functions. So those are functions that we need to link at runtime, and we'll get back to the whole linking portion at the end of this module. But printf, what it's saying there is we expect, if you're running my program on your system, I expect you to have the system libraries that contain those functions, and we'll link them at runtime. But the internal functions down here at the bottom, those are statically compiled into the binary. So we could say something like disassemble and disassemble one of those functions. So let's do the main function. So I'll hit disass, or you can tab complete and spell out the whole command, main. And what we have here on the left are the memory addresses. That's the virtual memory address as to where those instructions on the right are located. Now, if ASLR is on or if it's a position independent executable, this stuff will be randomized. So each time it would change, but ASLR and PI, which is position independent executable, are two different things. On Linux, ASLR randomizes the stack and the heap and the libraries, but it does not randomize the code segment and the procedure linkage table and things like that. You have to compile it as a PI to also randomize this. And that gets people a lot to say, I had ASLR on, why isn't this randomized? Well, because it wasn't compiled as a PI, and it's very common to see that. The majority of operating systems have ASLR on by default, but you may notice that the image itself, the binary, does not randomize. And again, depends on different factors. So we're going to leave ASLR off for now anyway, and we'll turn it on a little bit later just so we don't have things moving around while we're trying to learn. So these virtual memory addresses, now notice it says to the right, +0, +1, +3. Those are the offsets from the beginning of the function as to where that particular instruction on the right is located. So why does it jump around? Why sometimes is it plus only one byte difference and other times it's three or four? Because the instructions or the opcodes are different sizes. And that's something neat and unique about x86 and x64 in that the instructions are variable length. So how do we know how many bytes? We could say disassemble /R and then the function name. Now notice that it prints out the opcodes. It doesn't do that by default because it's kind of ugly on the screen, but you can see it if you want to with that /R option. But you can see that on the very top instruction, which is push EBP, that 55, it's a one byte opcode. So when the processor executes on x86 architecture, 55 opcode, that corresponds to the mnemonic push EBP. Then the next one down is a two byte opcode, right? Because it's got an opcode and an operand, well, actually, this time it's just a instruction and opcode. It says move ESP into EBP. It takes two bytes to represent that instruction. The next one down is three bytes. It says 83E450. So AND is the instruction, and on the right of that, those are the operands. Same thing above. Push is the instruction. EBP is the operand. Sometimes there might be an operand value as well. So just keep that in mind that these instructions are different length, and that's why you see the offsets changing over there. So we'll just do disassemble main again. And let's look at an example of some disassembly. Now notice if we run this program, if I say run, and then I give it an argument, it says there is no help or usage information. This program doesn't want us to pass it in an argument. But some programs do want you to pass it in one or more arguments, right? So that's, you've heard of argv, your argument vector, and argc, the argument counter. The code up here is actually checking that. It's saying right here, compare long one against what's stored at the base pointer plus 8. So wherever the base pointer is pointing, go to plus 8 from that location and compare the value stored there to 1. Then the next instruction says jump if less than or equal to this address. And that address, if we don't enter in an argument, takes us to the function called checkPW. We clearly didn't make it to the function called checkPW because it gave us that message that says it doesn't want any arguments or there's no help or usage information. That means that when it did this comparison here, because argv0, the argument vector 0, is always the program name that you're running. So there's always going to be one argument, and that is the program name itself. We entered in a second argument, though. I put AAAA, which meant that what was stored there at EBP plus 8 was 2. And it compared 2 against 1, and it said jump if less than or equal. Well, we weren't less than or equal. We were above that amount. So therefore, we moved this long value here to the top of the stack. How do I know it's the top of the stack? Because it's got parentheses around it. So it means pointer, go to the top of the stack and move this long value there. Well, let's take a look at what that is. So I'm going to copy that. We'll say X slash S. That means examine as a string what's stored at that address. And you can see what's stored at that address is a string. There is no help or usage information. That's the argument that's being passed to the putString function, which will just print that onto the screen. So that's all that's happening. And then it says move one to the top of the stack and exit. So a status code of one means that there was a problem. And that's what gets returned back. So we don't want to hit that. And it's because we entered in an argument that we did. If we don't enter in any arguments, we're going to take this jump here and we're going to jump to the checkPW function and hit what we're supposed to hit. So I'm going to clear my arguments and I'm going to type in run, but this time I don't enter in an argument. And notice now it says, please enter the password. I'll put AAAA. And it says access denied. So clearly we made it through a lot more code as opposed to when we entered in an argument. So that's an example of running some commands and doing a little bit of disassembly in GDB. We can also do a lot of other cool things. So we can, let's go and disassemble the main function again. I'm going to set a break on the call to the checkPW function. So we'll set a breakpoint. So to do that, I'm going to take this address here of the call to checkPW, and we'll copy it. I'm going to type in the command break, put an asterisk in because I'm telling it it's going to be a pointer here, and enter the address. So now we've got a breakpoint. If I want to see my breakpoints, I can say info break, and it shows them to me if there's more than one. We can also say delete breakpoint, and we can delete them. So if I say run now, we hit the breakpoint. If I want to see where the instruction pointer is currently pointing, I can say X slash I for examine as an instruction, EIP, and it says we are currently at this virtual memory address, which is the call to the checkPW function. So I'm exactly where we want to be. Now look at the main function. You can see where the instruction pointer is currently pointing, and we're about to call checkPW. What would the return pointer be? And if you guess 804.8555, you are correct. That's going to be what's used as the return pointer because after we execute the checkPW function, we want control to be returned back to that address. So we haven't let the call instruction execute yet. If we let it execute, it's going to push that value onto the stack. So let's say step one instruction, SI, step one instruction, and hit enter. And now if we look at what the stack pointer is pointing to, it's going to be pointing to that return pointer. Let's take a look. So I'll say X for examine slash 4WX. What that command does is says examine in hexadecimal, and I'm telling it to dump out 4 double words here. You can enter any number you want. And if we execute that, Let me give it the argument of stack pointer. It's dumping out, this is the stack pointer address over there on the left, and what it's pointing to at that address is this value here. And that's the return pointer we're expecting to see. So the stack pointer is pointing to the return pointer at this moment in time. Now, if we look to see what the instruction pointer is pointing at currently, so x/, I'm going to put 4i for four instructions. And again, you've got a GDB cheat sheet you can use, and also the lab instructions will tell you what you're supposed to enter, and you'll get used to it after a while. There's going to be a learning curve. You can see that we are pointing to the very beginning of the check PW function at its procedure prologue. There's that push EBP followed by the copy or move ESP into EBP. So it's exactly what we're expecting to see and what we walked through on the slides a bit ago. And that's building that stack frame. And at the end of the function, if we hit enter, we can repeat the command and we work our way down to the bottom. It's a much larger function. I skipped past it, but right down there is that return pointer, or the return instruction, I mean. And that's going to return control back to the caller. So some other things we can do since we're at a breakpoint, we can say info registers, and it's going to dump out all those general purpose registers we talked about, and we can see what's currently held in each of them. So we can dump out all this different context. We can look at the disassembly. We can set breakpoints. We can examine memory anywhere we want. So again, it's what a debugger does, and it's very powerful. Let's go back out to the slides. So assembly language, just a quick intro there. What is it? It's a very low-level programming language. It's not very intuitive. Back in the day, people used to write opcodes, right? We would just write the opcodes straight out of our head, and you're like a binary ninja if you could do that. But memorizing things like C3 is a return instruction is kind of difficult, or return opcode is kind of difficult. So let me kind of draw out what I mean here. So I'm just going to draw a few opcodes, and we'll start with 0D, followed by a double word. And then the next one we'll put in 90, which I'm sure you've heard of. It's a NOP instruction. We'll get back to that. And then we'll do 41, and I'm going to convert this or disassemble it soon. And then let's do a couple more. We'll end with the C3, which is a return instruction. So I'll put that down at the bottom. And I'll put one more in here. We'll put, let me come up with a decent one. I'm trying to think of the opcode for subtract with borrowed byte. I think it's 1B. So what I've just written up there is a series of opcodes. That's not easy to do. There's thousands of opcodes. So how would you write a program this way? You'd have to be pretty crazy, right? Or have incredibly good memory. So if we disassemble this, that's what disassembly is doing. We're disassembling those opcodes, and we're taking that first one, which means OR EAX followed by a double word. So that's what 0D is. It's OR EAX is what the opcode means, and then it takes a double word. 90 is going to be a NOP, so it's a no operation used for timing or spacing. 41, which is also a capital A in hex ASCII, is the instruction increment, I don't need to put uppercase, increment EAX or ECX, I think. 1B is subtract with borrow byte, and then C3 is return. Now, what I've just shown you is manual disassembly. We take the opcodes on the left, we disassemble them into their mnemonic on the right. That's disassembly. We are not writing assembly when we do this. We're disassembling the opcodes. And that disassembly can be in two different flavors, which is AT&T or Intel. And we're going to walk through what both look like here in a moment. Now, the disassembly does not change the code because we're disassembling. It's already compiled. It's just changing the way in how it's displaying it to us. Back to here, though, if we're writing assembly, it's using those mnemonics, those instructions, instead of writing just the opcodes. It should be a little bit easier to write the mnemonics down and assemble those into the machine code than it is to just write machine code out of your head. So it's early on programming language. It's extremely powerful, though, and extremely fast. You can get the processor to do things that the compiler wouldn't have had it do. You can directly access those processor registers and, again, do anything. So extremely powerful and fast, but could be potentially dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. Disassembling, again, is what I just demonstrated. And there are those two syntax flavors, AT&T or Intel. Most people use Intel, but there's also AT&T. If you can read one, you can read the other. You just need to know the differences between the two. So look on the left under AT&T. It says subtract 48 from ESP. Now notice there's a dollar sign and a percent sign. The dollar sign means immediate operand. That instruction is saying subtract the literal value, hexadecimal 48, from percent ESP. That means indirect, from what's stored in the stack pointer. When we do that, we're allocating buffer space because we're changing the address held in ESP to negative hex 48 from what it used to point to. And remember, the stack grows from high memory towards low memory, so subtracting is allocating. Now, that's AT&T syntax. Over on the right, that's the same opcode, but disassembled into the different flavor. So as we're on the left, we're saying subtract this from that. Intel, we've swapped the source and destination, and we're saying subtract from this that. So you've got to read it a little differently. The source and destination operands change order. Back to the left, we see the instruction. The second one down says move ESP into EBP. Percent sign means indirect operand, so we're copying the contents of the stack pointer into the base pointer. It wouldn't make sense to use a dollar sign there because that's used for immediate operands like numbers. Over on the right, we swap the source and destination in Intel syntax. We say move into this, that is how you would read it. So again, on the left on AT&T, move this into that. On the right, Intel, move into this, that. There's also on the AT&T side at the bottom, parentheses mean pointer, and in Intel, square brackets mean pointer. And you'll see an example on the next slide. So what we want to do now is walk through another example. On the top is AT&T. On the bottom is the exact same instruction, but in the Intel syntax. So notice they look a little bit different. So let's read the top one first. It says move long value, 32 bits. If it was a 64-bit value, it'd say move Q for move quad word. It could say move B for move byte. So that letter on the end for AT&T is meaningful. So it says move the long 32-bit immediate operand. So dollar sign means immediate. So literally take that value and move it into the top of the stack. We are writing that immediate operand, that memory address, to the top of the stack, not into the stack pointer because there's parentheses. It's a pointer. If the parentheses weren't there, then we'd be moving that memory address into the stack pointer. But since there's parentheses around it, we're saying write that address to wherever the stack pointer is pointing, to the top of the stack. So move the long immediate operand value into the top of the stack. On the bottom there, notice that it spells out D word pointer. Instead of using L, it says D word pointer, and it swaps the operand order. So it says move into the top of the stack, because square brackets for Intel, the operand on the right. So move into the top of the stack, that. So hopefully that clarifies a bit. And I'll show you one more example here, going back to the debugger. So let's look at the main function. And that's what it looks like in AT&T syntax. Now let's set the disassembly flavor. So set disassembly flavor Intel. And now we'll run that same command. See how it changed it? Now it spells out D word pointer and such. It's not changing the code because it's already compiled. It's just disassembling it into a different syntax for you. And you can change it back to AT&T if you want. Some people get real religious about the disassembly flavor. I have no idea why. If you can read one, you can read both. It's pretty simple. So our last section here in this first module is linking and loading. And what we really care about is linking in this case. So that's primarily what we'll be talking about. But loaders are going to be loading a program from storage into memory, and it's going to read and parse through the sections to look to see how much initial memory is needed, how much space for the heap, the layout of memory. So all that stuff's going to be done by the loader. The linker is going to resolve symbols for you. A symbol is nothing more than a function name. And I use this bad analogy. Some of them work, some of them don't. So I just assume they're all bad, but I hope some of them work for you. If I, let's say I were to come over to your house, and I cook Thai food a lot. It's like my favorite food. So if I was going to come over to your house and cook Thai food, do you expect me to bring and back up a big truck and start unloading a oven and chairs and tables and silverware and even like a portable toilet? Like that sounds ridiculous. No one would do that. But I do need to bring with me the ingredients for what I'm trying to make. So think of that as like a statically compiled program versus a dynamically linked program. We don't statically compile programs because for a couple reasons. One, it becomes unnecessarily large, and I already know that you've got functions like printf and malloc on your target system. So why would I compile that stuff statically in? The other reason is you don't want to compile statically these dynamic modules, because what if a vulnerability is disclosed or a change is made to a particular library or function and you've got the statically compiled version? You'd have to recompile it, or else there could be a vulnerability in there or other problems. So we don't typically do that. So when I compile my program and you run it on your system, we need to link the functionality. So going back to my example, if I get to your house with the ingredients for the food I'm going to make, I do need to know where your kitchen is, where your oven is, where your cutlery is. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to say, hey, where is your refrigerator? And you'll tell me. And now I've linked that. I don't need to ask you again because you told me, at least per process invocation. Now, if you kill the process and start it again, yeah, it's going to have to relink. So now that I know where these things are, I'm going to write the answers to where things are located into a particular table called the global offset table, or the GOT. And we'll get back to that in a moment. But that should explain to you what symbol resolution is. It's if I need to run a program, or if you're running my program on your system, and I need to link functionality, I need to tell you what modules and functions I need, and there needs to be a way to link that functionality so that my process knows where they are. Relocation could also occur, which just means if, let's say we go to mmap a module to an address that's already in use, well, that's not going to work, right? So we need to relocate it or fix it up. And there's a table that holds that information if necessary. There's also name mangling that occurs depending on the languages and the compilers. That's generally trying to avoid namespace conflicts and other items, but really don't care about that for this course. So ELF is the executable and linking format. That is the object file format for Linux. On Windows, it's PECOF, which stands for Portable Executable Common Object File Format. And we'll get back to that on the Windows section. There are two primary formats, though, or primary types that utilize the ELF object file format, and that is executable files like ping and like GDB and nmap, or shared objects like libc.so.6. So libraries and executables both use the ELF object file format. Now, this is a little bit weird, but that's just the way it was designed. I have no idea why they chose this way, but that's how it works. On Windows, we've got the import address table and export address table, and we'll talk about that in the Windows section. On Linux, we've got procedure linkage table and global offset table. They work in tandem, and they have to do with dynamic dependencies, meaning that if I compile my code and I've got a dependency on string copy and malloc and printf, those functions that my program is dependent on will be written into the procedure linkage table so that they can be resolved at runtime when you run my code or my program on your system. So the procedure linkage table is executable, and it stores every function that we need to resolve at runtime will have its own entry in both the PLT and the GOT. The difference is the PLT is executable, and the global offset table holds the resolved pointers to the functions that have been linked. And I'm going to walk you through an example here. Now, the slides will walk you through from a slide perspective, but I'm actually just going to demo it so you can see it happening. But the slides recreate that, so you can feel free to walk through that as well. But we're going to walk through how a function gets linked at runtime when it's needed. Now, unless you use a compiler option that says to link everything at right at the beginning of process invocation, then it's going to do something called lazy linking, which means don't ask for something until you need it. Back to my analogy with the cooking food at your house thing, if I got to your front door and you open the door, I typically am not going to say, where's your stove? Where are the utensils? Where is the table? Where are the chairs? Where is your bathroom? Like, I'm not going to ask you everything I could possibly need to know right at the beginning. I'm going to wait until I actually need it and say, oh, where is your living room? And then I'll link it when I need it. So from a security perspective, it's better to do all that resolving right at the beginning and then harden the global offset table so it's not writable. But many programs are compiled to do lazy linking. So what's going to happen from a high level before I walk you through it? We get to a line of code that says call printf. If that's the first time I need to call printf, that's a dynamic dependency. I did not statically compile that into my code. So we need to link it. I'm then going to go to the procedure linkage table, and there's going to be an entry in there specifically for printf and anything else I need to link. And it's going to say jump to the pointer for printf that should be stored in the global offset table entry for printf. So again, printf will have its own entry in the procedure linkage table and the global offset table. So we say call printf at PLT. We go to the PLT. It says jump to the pointer for printf in the GOT, but we haven't yet linked it. So it's going to point us straight back down to the PLT, and we're going to call the dynamic linker. The dynamic linker is going to go and resolve the location of printf, and it's going to write the answer into the global offset table. And now going forward, we don't have to do the dynamic linking portion again. So let's look at that in a debugger. So I'm going to drop out for a moment. And we're going to use a tool called OBJ dump, which is object dump. It's a disassembler, but it also can parse through the section headers. I'm going to use the minus R command for relocation entries, which is going to dump out the global offset table. And you can see there's the global offset table. Those functions on the right are the dynamic dependencies of this password program. And we're going to watch the gets function get resolved. Now notice this memory address on the left is gets entry in the global offset table. So that's a specific slot created to hold the address of the gets function. But that won't happen until we go to call it and we link it first. So remember that address 804A004. I'm just going to copy it now. And we're going to go inside GDB to the password program. And I'm just going to clear the screen here. Now, right now, if I say examine what's stored at that address, put a 0x in the front so it knows it's hexadecimal. That's what's there right now. It tells you that's gets entry in the global offset table. What's stored there right now is that address. We're going to set a breakpoint on the call to gets. So I'm going to say disassemble the checkpw function, and right there is the call to the gets function. So we grab that address, and I'm going to say break on it with the asterisk in the front, and I'll say run. So we say run, we hit the breakpoint. You can see what the instruction pointer is pointing to. It's pointing to the call to gets. It has not yet been linked. Now notice it says gets at PLT. That's because it's a dynamic dependency. This address that we're calling is the address of gets in the procedure linkage table. So if I say step one instruction, look what address we just went to. It's the same one. We are inside gets entry in the PLT. Let's look at the instruction there. It says jump to the pointer in the global offset table entry for gets. That was the address we saw with object dump. Now, right now, if we look at that address again, right there, you can see the address that it points to is really close to where the instruction pointer is currently pointing. It's only 6 bytes away. That's because what's happening is we haven't yet linked it. The global offset table is saying, I don't have the answer for you. You need to go call the dynamic linker. So if we say step instruction, you can see the instruction pointer is still in the procedure linkage table entry for gets. We didn't actually go to the real address of the gets function. And if we hit enter to repeat that command, we end up going into LD Linux shared object. That's going to call the linker, and it's going to write the answer into the global offset table. So I'm going to say continue. So C, continue. And it says, please enter the password. So now it's been linked. I'm going to hit control C to force a break. And if you ever want to continue, just hit C. We forced the breakpoint. Let's go back and look what's in the global offset table entry for guess. It was 804.8366, and now it's this different address. That's because it's been linked. So we take that address and we say examine, let's say, 8 instructions starting at that address. And you can see we're actually in the gets function now. So that's now it's been, now that it's been linked. And you may be asking, like, why do we care about this? The reason we care about this is because the global offset table in this case is writable, right? It's, and it holds pointers to functions that the program is dependent on. So what if we get a write what where opportunity where we can overwrite an entry in the global offset table? That means when the process goes to call that function, it ends up calling our attacker code. That's why we care about this kind of stuff. It's a location where function pointers are stored. And if we can overwrite an entry, we can gain control. All right. So I'm skipping through the slides here because that's what we just walked through, this demonstration. And we're at the summary here. So that's a pretty heavy module, right? That's a lot of information. Don't be surprised if you want to go back and listen to it a couple of times and make sure you read through the notes as well, because obviously it has a little more information to fill in the gaps here. But hopefully you've now got a better understanding as to what the processor registers are used for, virtual to physical address translation, how the stack operates, assembly language, and then of course linking and loading that we just finished up. And each module, on some of these modules anyway, there's a couple review questions here if you want to go and take a shot at answering them. And then the answers are on the next page with possibly an explanation. And also, some of the modules will have some recommended reading, so feel free to take a look at those as well. I apologize if any of the URLs in any of the notes are invalid. We do go through the course many times a year and update those URLs, but obviously the internet is always changing and links go dead. You should be able to just take the subject matter and do a Google query and find the location of those resources if they ever change. Let's continue and take a look at introduction to shellcode. Now, in order to have an effective shellcode module, we'd have to spend a whole day or multiple days on it. I shouldn't say module, I should say an effective shellcode section. We would want to spend a day or more on it. And to be fair, most of us go to Metasploit or, you know, MSF Venom or whatever, or online at some resource, and we get shellcode from those locations. Most of us are not writing our own shellcode. Now, some do, especially if it's a more obscure architecture or if you're trying to do something very specific. You may also open up shellcode that's already been written by someone else with a disassembler and make edits to it to try to do what's called ghostwriting to get around antivirus signature checks. There might be times when you actually do have to go in and do some of that. But we didn't feel that it's a good use of our time in the course to take a whole lot of time or spend too much time on authoring shellcode. That being said, I did want to have an introduction to shellcode authoring and how that looks and how you would approach it in case it is some direction that you want to take. So for this module, we're going to look at basics, system calls, how we would get about writing shellcode, removing null bytes, and then importantly, testing shellcode. Because I ask a question in class all the time when I'm at live events, and I say, show of hands, how many of you have ever used shellcode without first reverse engineering it to make sure it's doing what it says it's doing? And, you know, every hand goes up, or some people just don't want to raise their hand, because we've all done that. We've all used shellcode from Metasploit or from another exploit that we've seen online on a website or wherever, and we just assume for whatever reason that shellcode must be safe because I'm using it. It's an attacker tool. But to be fair, absolutely, it could have a Trojan in it, or a backdoor or something like that, or it could do something completely different than what you think it's going to do. So what we'll do is test shellcode at the end of this. How would you go about checking that, at least from a high level? So why is it called shellcode? Long time ago, it was assembly code or C code that was assembled or compiled to spawn a shell. It would serve as our payload. We would exploit a vulnerability, and if our exploit was successful, we'd gain code execution, and we typically would execute our shell code, which would spawn a shell. It's written in assembly or C. It's specific to a processor type or architecture. So x86 shellcode or x64 shellcode is going to look different than ARM because it's in a different instruction set. And again, we inject this somehow into a process, and during exploitation, we execute our shellcode or payload. So system calls. One thing that's interesting on Linux, and I brought up this system call table here, is it's static. So the 32-bit syscall table and the 64-bit syscall table are static on Linux. So if we say syscall number 11, you can see right there on the screen, that maps to execve, and that would be 0B. So if we want to make that system call, that's the system call number that corresponds to execve. And then it shows you to the right of that the arguments to execve and which registers should hold those arguments. And you can look at the table for 32-bit or 64-bit. Now that's useful or makes things easier. We know it's relatively static. If we wrote code 10 years ago and we ran it on a modern Linux OS now, it probably still work right out of the box. On Windows, it's much more dynamic. We'll get to that in book 5. But just wanted to point that out.